Mario Balotelli is a footballer who used to play for Manchester City. He's played for a lot of different teams, but he used to play for Manchester City. And one season, a few things happened to him. It had been in the press, and some of them were embarrassing for him. Some of them he'd gotten into trouble for. And one week, he scored a goal. And as they sometimes do, they lift their shirt over their head. And Mario Balotelli did that to reveal a T-shirt underneath that said, "Why always me? Why always me?" And I wonder how many times we've asked that question in life in general. Why always me? Why has this happened to me? Sticking with the same theme of football, last game of the season, 2011 to 2012, again, involving Manchester City, they need to match Man United's result to win the title. And they're at home to Queen's Park Rangers, who are right at the bottom of the league. And so it looks like it's nailed on. Everybody's saying Man City are going to win their first title for a very long time. But heading into injury time in that match, Man United have already beaten Sunderland 1-0. I'm there at the Stadium of Light. We lost 1-0. Didn't really matter to us. We were sat mid-table, which is, you know, feels like a million miles away compared to today's current situation. But we've lost 1-0 to Man United. The Man United fans are getting, you know, they're celebrating at the other end of the stadium because they think they've snatched the title from City on the last day. Even the players on the pitch are looking pretty joyful. But the game at the Etihad Stadium is still going on. They're deep into injury time and it's 2-2. And, you know, what's going to happen? It looks like City are going to miss out. And then it happens. 93rd minute or whatever it is, the ball breaks to Aguero in the box and he smashes it past the keeper and the Etihad Stadium literally explodes. I mean, they probably could have heard the volume, I don't know, 40, 50, 60 miles away. When you see it on the TV, if you find a clip of it on YouTube, the volume in there must have been deafening. And as the news breaks to the Stadium of Light, obviously, the Man United fans just look all pretty deflated and depressed. And the Sunderland fans, you know, as was our prerogative, we decided we'd take the mick out of them. But there's more about that later. You could find out what happened when we, if you want to chat to me afterwards. Before kick-off, everybody said City would win the title. But nobody could have predicted how it would end. Nobody could have written that script beforehand. Nobody was going to guess that it would be a 93rd minute goal after being 2-1 down. They win 3-2. It all goes crazy. Why has it always happened to me? Or why has it happened to me? And the unpredictability of we never know what is going to happen or necessarily how it's going to happen. And Ecclesiastes 8 and 9, in many senses, you might be saying, well, look, I've heard some of this before in the previous 7 chapters. And we have. We've got a bit more about wisdom in here and its limits. We've got a bit more about the nature of life and what it's like to live under the sun. We've got a bit more about our lack of control over the things that take place in our own lives and around us. And we've got more about our need of God. So, looking at these verses then, start back at chapter 8, verse 1. There's a little picture given, which is quite an interesting one, isn't it? Right at the very beginning, a wise person's face is brightened and softened. It's like you can tell a wise person by looking at them. And it's an interesting thought. And we could probably talk about that for a while and say, well, what is he really getting at? But the main thrust of verses 1 to 6 seem to be about how those wise people, whoever they might be, respond to those in power. In particular, in this case, how wise people respond to the king. Smiling in the king's court was a wise thing to do. Frowning or looking sad in the king's court was a bad thing to do. If you've read Nehemiah chapter 1, you know that's the case. Nehemiah is sad at the state of Jerusalem. He goes into the king and his face is sad. He doesn't look like he normally does in front of the king. And that was a big issue because the king could have just gone, I don't want you in my presence. See you later. Had him killed and replaced instantly. Now in the story of Nehemiah, which is again a story for another day, that isn't what happens. But Nehemiah takes a huge risk to go in, looking sad. And the preacher is saying a very similar thing here. Be careful, be wise in how you respond to the king, how you present yourself to those in authority, because they've got the power. He's basically saying, if you've got an issue with something the king has done, it's probably best to excuse yourself from his presence than stand in opposition to him in his court. Well, the preacher was saying, kind of, don't hang around in a bad situation. Use your wisdom, save it for another day. He's basically saying you need to obey the king. If you have to rebel, choose the right time to do it. Ultimately, the preacher's saying there's a time for everything. Even if the king has done something you think it's not been a good thing to do, remember that ultimately, and it's not necessarily explicit here, but remember ultimately there is a time for divine judgment. Chapter 3 said there was a time for everything. And he's saying even if the king has done something and it's not great and you're a bit miffed about it, or it's unjust, the king is ultimately going to have to answer to God. You don't have to sort it all out yourself. Be wise in how you respond to those in authority. And it's not just the preacher who says that here. If we jump forward to the New Testament, we look at 1 Peter, which we did last year in our Bible studies. Peter says a similar thing to those who are suffering for their faith under unjust leaders. He says, submit yourselves for the Lord's sake to every human authority, whether to the emperor as the supreme authority or to governors who are sent by him to punish those who do wrong and commend those who do right. For it is God's will that by doing good you should silence the ignorant talk of foolish people. Live as free people, but do not use your freedom as a cover-up for evil. Live as God's slaves. Show proper respect to everyone. Love the family of believers, fear God, and honour the emperor. Sometimes, the preacher says, and Peter says, we'll have to suffer at the hands of unjust rulers. Sometimes we will have to keep living for Jesus and face the consequences of living for Jesus. Everybody who's ever lived lives in a particular time, in a particular place, with a particular context and a particular culture. But the call of the gospel is always to follow Jesus. And so that will mean sometimes going against the flow. As Christians, we dance to a different tune, don't we? It's like being in a silent disco. And Christians are all slow dancing to Mozart while everybody else is bopping to ABBA. Or the Christians are rocking it out to Bon Jovi while everybody else is having their minds numbed by trance music. Pick your favourite, shove it in there, and the point is it's going to look very, very different, isn't it? As Christians, we have pledged allegiance to a country that doesn't have borders and doesn't have politicians. We've pledged allegiance to God's country, to a heavenly city, to a different kingdom that is not of this world. So we need to respond to the governments in this world who've been put there by God with caution and patience and with faith and with integrity. If push comes to shove, like the apostles do in Acts 5, the bottom line is we have to obey God and not men. But in the meantime, we faithfully follow Jesus and act with integrity, even when we might be unjustly treated for doing so. That's the first bit about wisdom, using that wisdom to respond rightly to those in charge. But the preacher says, goes on to say even, nobody knows the future. Verse 7, chapter 8. Nobody can control the wind or control the spirit. It's the same word there. And so it could be that he's saying, actually, nobody can control the day of their death, because that's what the next line also says. Nobody has power over when they'll die. And in light of it coming after the first few verses, his point is, not even the king knows when he'll die. He might have all the power, seemingly, but he still can't predict or control the day that he's going to die. The king might bring misery and harm. He might act wickedly. But again, the preacher says, those in wickedness will not be released by that wickedness. They're kind of trapped by their own wickedness. He repeats the idea again that those in charge can often lord it over others, but actually damage themselves at the same time. Verse 9. He says to us that there were people who were wicked who used to go to the temple and carry out all the rituals, but were basically being hypocrites, but they too died and were buried. He then tells us that there are people who do wicked things, don't face the judgment for it, and think, oh, well, I'll just keep doing more wicked things because I've not faced the consequences. I've not been judged for it. I've not been condemned for it. He even says somebody might do evil 100 times over and live a long life, but ultimately, he says, it won't go well for them. It goes well, he says, for those who fear God. The wicked might seem to be prosperous, he says, in this life. They might seem to get away with it. But in the end, it's not worth anything. It's not worth anything. Those who are reverent before God are the ones who it will go well with. It won't go well for the wicked who do not fear God, verse 13. The preacher also concludes the chapter by pointing out that under the sun, life in this world, as he's observed it, and we, I would imagine, could say exactly the same thing, as we observe life in this world, bad things happen to good people, and good things happen to bad people. It's verse 14. And similarly in chapter 9, verses 2 and 3, he says the same thing. It seems unfair. And he can't get his head round it. He can't get his head round why there is a common destiny for the righteous and the wicked, for the good and the bad, the clean and the unclean. It seems like things are very random. It seems like you get dealt a set of cards and what you get is the luck of the draw and tough. Our kids got given a game for Christmas called Ocean Bingo. And it's got some animals on there that I didn't even know existed. I mean, they're crazy. Beautiful, but crazy. It's quickly become a household favourite. And I think the reason it's partly become a household favourite is because the kids like to make up calls for the different sea creatures. Now, if you want to know what those calls are, when lockdown ends, come round and request a game of Ocean Bingo and you'll find out. And you'll have a laugh. It will do your heart good. It really will. But the point is, who wins is the person who gets the first line and then the person who gets the full house. But it's just luck. Because the tiles are in a bag that isn't see-through and they're jumbled and something's picked out. Nobody knows what's coming next. It doesn't matter if you're playing with your favourite board, and they've all got one already, a favourite board to play on, as though that's going to be the winning board because it's their favourite. Doesn't matter whether you've got the blue whale and the emperor penguin or the leatherback sea turtle on it or not. It doesn't matter whether you're playing with the brain coral and the sock-eyed salmon and the sea cucumber. Doesn't matter what your board's got on it. Your chances of winning are the same because it is random. Preacher's saying life can feel and look like a game of bingo. Some get lines and some win prizes and others don't. It's what it looks like, he says. Question is, do we believe then that life is just random chance, just bad luck? Are we really at the mercy of blind forces? It's what the consistent atheists would say nowadays. Life is just completely random. There is no meaning, no purpose, no rhyme or reason to anything. It's just pure luck. The question is, can we really live that way? Can we really live with that being the reality? Now, if God is not in the equation, that is all we're left with. If God is not in the equation, that is absolutely all we're left with. But there is then no hope, no reason, no explanation. For the preacher, though, God is in the equation. So what's his answer? What are we going to do about it? If that's what life looks like, how do we respond to that? Now, the preacher doesn't give us a nicely packaged, easy solution, which is a good thing, because I think sometimes we try to give simple answers to complicated questions when we shouldn't, because the answer's not simple, it's complicated. Or we try and explain things that we don't really grasp, because we feel the need to at least put something out there. Sometimes we actually just need to say, I don't know. I don't know why that happened. And we need to admit that because life is outside of our control. We've seen that in the chapters so far. We see it here. There are things that we can do and there are ways that we should act. We shouldn't do nothing, but we can't do everything. Life is unfair as we observe it often. It makes us angry, doesn't it, when we find out that someone has been abused in some way, shape or form, but there's not enough evidence to convict the person who's obviously guilty. And we think, how can that be? Everybody knows they've done it. It makes us sick to the stomach when children who should be looked after and loved by the people closest to them aren't. It makes our blood boil when people in power misuse that power at the expense of the needy and the vulnerable to get ahead. It might frustrate us currently that in a global pandemic, the evidence seems to be that the richer have got richer and the poorer have got poorer. And so the gap is bigger than it was before. But we can't answer the question, why? Why has that happened? We can't give specific reasons for all of those things, can we? Sometimes we have to say, I just don't know why it's happened. Let's be more specific. Why did a 65-year-old man walking his dog down Bishy cycle track get asked for a light by a young man who then beat him up and stole his dog a month ago? Why? It's not fair, is it? Doesn't seem fair. Why did a young dad of two get killed near Stockton Town Centre a couple of weeks ago? Doesn't seem fair. Why did you get cancer and your friend not? Why did your family member contract COVID when your abusive neighbour who flouted all the rules for the last 12 months didn't? It doesn't seem fair. And the answer is we don't know, do we? In one sense, the big picture is we live in a fallen world and it's not the way that it should be. But we can't nail down reasons. I can't give a reason, and neither can you, as to why those specific things happened, ultimately. So how do we respond? Do we just give up and despair? Because that would be a very legitimate response in one sense, wouldn't it? Look again at verses 17 and 18 of chapter 8. The preacher doesn't despair and throw in the towel. He realises that he can't explain it all and he can't box it up in a nice pretty little package. But what keeps him going is ultimately that God is just. What he sees in the world doesn't make him think God's justice is gone. What he says is, I just can't fathom God's justice. I can't figure out how and why and when God's justice is going to come about. But I know it will happen, he says. He trusts that God is ultimately just. He is sure that there will be justice for the oppressed. He is sure they will get their day in court. The preacher is sure that there is a higher throne and there is a greater wisdom than anything on this earth. The preacher trusts God with it. Verse 9, he says, it's in God's hands. Sorry, not verse 9, verse 1 of chapter 9. All that is done is in God's hands. God might seem absent under the sun, but he's not, the preacher says. He is working. We just can't always see where and how. But living in the time that we do, after Jesus coming to earth, we can know more clearly than the preacher that justice will be done, because we can see the cross of Christ. And that is the anchor for us that God will act justly, because it is at the cross where the justice and mercy of God are most clearly displayed. The sin and the injustice and the evil in the world grieved God the Father and the Son so much that the Son came and dealt with it in the only way that it could be dealt with. In the only way that could give human beings a way to be saved and simultaneously deal with the problem of sin. When Jesus went to the cross, he gave his life to pay the price for sin. When Jesus went to the cross, it said that justice would be done. When Jesus went to the cross, it showed the utter seriousness of the depth of our sin. It showed God's hatred of evil and injustice and oppression and abuse and wickedness and so on. It showed us how seriously God takes those things and that ultimately he will deal with them all. The cross of Jesus means our wicked rebellion can also be forgiven. But it also means, and we don't like this part quite often, the cross of Jesus means that those who sin against us can also be forgiven. It shows us that if sins aren't forgiven, yes, those who are guilty will ultimately pay the price themselves. But that's the outrageousness of the grace of God, isn't it, at the cross? There is forgiveness for all who will turn from sin and trust in Jesus. And yet the warning for those who won't is that there is an eternity away from God and all of his goodness in the place that the Bible calls hell. How will we respond then to what we see in the world? Will we see that there is no hope without God? There is no hope without God for us or for anybody else. Will we look at it all and we will just simply despair? Or will we instead do what we can to stand up for and help others, deal justly? Will we see that the evil and the injustice that we like to point our finger at in the world is not just in the world, but is in us? Will we see that we are part of the problem too, and so we need to throw ourselves upon the mercy of God? Will we run to Jesus? Will we tell others about Jesus? Will we, as people who observe the world, see that actually without Jesus there's no hope, and so people need to hear about Jesus? Will our lives display the fact that there is no hope without Jesus? Will we live as those who have hope in front of a watching world? Well, think a bit more about what the preacher says, because he says it twice and we're going to come to it at the end, about another part of our response to what we see in the world. But as well as life under the sun looking unfair, we also find that it's unpredictable. So chapter 8, verses 7 and 8 say this: since no one knows the future, who can tell somebody else what is to come? As no one has power over the wind to contain it, so no one has the power over the time of their death. As no one is discharged in a time of war, so wickedness will not release those who practice it. And chapter 9, verses 11 and 12 say, I have seen something else under the sun. The race is not to the swift, the battle to the strong, nor does food come to the wise, or wealth to the brilliant, or favor to the learned. But time and chance happen to them all. Moreover, no one knows when their hour will come. As fish are caught in a cruel net, or birds taken in a snare, so people are trapped by evil times that fall unexpectedly upon them. I mean, usually the fastest person wins the race, right? Usually they line up. Everybody knows who's the quickest. Everybody knows who holds the world record. Everybody knows who in the Olympics. And so usually you can go 100 metres a few years ago. Usain Bolt, he'll win. He's the fastest man in the world. But how often have you seen live on TV, even in an Olympic Games, the race begin and the favourite pull up with a hamstring injury? Partway down the home stretch, it's like they've been shot in the back of the leg. And everybody else keeps going, and the favourite, gold medal, no longer. Finishes last, he might not even cross the line. Usually the strongest person wins the fight, but how many times have there been major upsets in boxing history? The underdog wins. Maybe because the favourite thought it was going to be easy and wasn't prepared, but the underdog wins. Usually clever people are able to use that intelligence to make money, right? That's what he says. But what about stock market crashes that come out of nowhere? All the money's gone. Wiped out in an instant. Time and chance, the preacher says, happen to everyone. And we know it's true. We observe it. But because it's true, the preacher says, well, if we see those things are true, we need to then realize that we have to live in the light of death. Because death comes to us all, and none of us knows when that will be. I am probably physically the fittest I've ever been in my life, right? I've done a lot of exercise. I've tried to keep myself more fit. And I probably am the fittest I've ever been, even than when I was a teenager, because I really wasn't fit when I was a teenager. I'm pretty sure that medically speaking, I've probably got a longer life expectancy now than then, purely on physical statistics. But I could walk to the shop tomorrow, to the spa, to get a bar of chocolate and get hit by a bus. Physical fitness then doesn't matter, does it? If it's me versus the bus, the bus is going to win. Doesn't matter how fit I am. Or more ironically, I could get knocked over while I'm running. I might be able to control what I eat. I might be able to choose when and where I exercise. I might be able to get good patterns of sleeping, going to bed at sensible hours, getting up at sensible hours. And not that any of those things are bad things to do, but if I think that they give me some kind of control over my life and mean that I can ignore the reality of death, I need the biblical wake-up call of Ecclesiastes. Because I can't do that. I don't know when I will die, and neither do you. Because the bottom line is, none of us is really in control. And everyone, without exception, will die. Nobody can predict what will happen. But everyone, without exception, will stand before God. And so again, how do we respond? The preacher concludes that because of all this unpredictability, people should enjoy what God has given. They should be thankful for all of his gifts and use them in the way that he has said they should be used. That's chapter 8, verse 15, if you want to look back down at it. And chapter 9, verse 7, they say basically the same thing. He says, work hard in everything you do to the best of your ability. What's in front of you, do it, and do it well. If you're married, he says, enjoy your wife. And if you've not got time to do that, he says, you're simply too busy. Get it sorted. And that's not just a message to husbands. You could flip it around and say, if you're married, enjoy your husband. If you've not got enough time to do that, you're simply too busy. Get it sorted. Equally, if you're single, enjoy it. It's a gift from God. Take the advantage of what it allows you to do. Everybody, enjoy a good meal out with friends when it's allowed, when lockdown ends. Have a greasy takeaway with your family. Just don't have it too late or you'll get the indigestion we talked about the other week. Kick back on the sofa, eat a full tub of Ben and Jerry's in front of a film and enjoy it for what it is. You might say, hold on a minute, this just sounds very worldly, Matt. Well, the difference between the way a Christian enjoys these things and everybody else is that when we feast, rather than it being the thing, well, we'll just do this because, well, we're going to die and so we might as well do it. Actually, for us as we feast, we should be looking beyond death to the feast. Any feast we enjoy now is a pale shadow of the feast that is to come, the wedding feast of the Lamb. And we should do it with a thankful heart. Because good gifts from God are to be received and to be enjoyed, all of them. Enjoyed in the here and now for what they are. And actually, we can only truly enjoy created gifts when we don't worship them. And so that's the difference for the Christian too. We worship God, we enjoy his gifts. And so we should be those who truly enjoy his gifts. We don't know what will happen tomorrow. Can't control it, we can't predict it. It's not just in here in Ecclesiastes. We could have looked at some of Jesus' own words. We could have looked at James chapter 4. They say the same thing. Doesn't matter what the horoscopes predict. It doesn't matter if a clairvoyant tells you what's going to happen next week. They don't know. Death gives a great perspective. Think about the people you know who've maybe at some point in your life been given a terminal diagnosis. They know that they're going to die for sure. It brings it into sharper focus in a way that maybe general life doesn't. They still don't know the moment they're going to die, but they know it's coming soon. What do they usually do? They prioritize everything, don't they? They prioritize everything. They do the things that they love doing because they know they've got not long left to do them. They prioritize the people that they love. They want to spend quality time with them. The question is, why don't the rest of us do that? Why don't we do that with our lives generally? We might not have been given a terminal diagnosis, but we were born with one. All of us born with a terminal diagnosis. Every human being dies. So why don't we live like that? So one of the responses the preacher gives is that of enjoying what God has given us in the light of our impending death. The second thing he says is to stand amazed at God. Hold your hands up and say, God's ways are higher than mine. He holds it all in his hands. He said that, hasn't he, already? It's in God's hands. He is just, and I've got to trust him, the preacher says. He will make sure everything is sorted out in the end. We need to remember that God isn't there to give us health and healing. God isn't there to give us natural, material blessings or an easy life. God is there to be worshipped. The Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit are to be praised and glorified, full stop. God doesn't just deserve the glory when things go well for us. God doesn't just deserve the praise when our prayers are answered in the way we wanted them to be answered. God is to be worshipped because he's God. He is God. We are not. He knows all things, and all things are in God's hands. And when it comes to our lives, we need to remember that we are his mortal creatures. And he has appointed a day when he will judge all men through his Son. Mankind has one life to live, and after that is destined to face judgment. And so how do we respond? Well, listen to 2 Peter 3. Don't forget this one thing, dear friends. With the Lord, a day is like 1,000 years, and 1,000 years is like a day. The Lord is not slow in keeping his promise, as some understand slowness. Indeed, he is patient with you, not wanting anyone to perish, but everyone to come to repentance. How do we respond to the fact that one day we will die and face judgment? Don't presume on God's kindness. Don't presume on God's kindness. Every breath in our lungs is an opportunity for us to turn from sin and worship God alone. Every breath. Every breath is an opportunity to repent of sin today. Repent of rebellion against him and know the forgiveness and love of Jesus. Because one day all things will be put right, all things will be laid bare, and all things will be seen from God's perfect perspective. And as Christians, we remember that everything is in God's hands. Nothing escapes his knowledge. Every detail of history is known. Every thought, every action, every word, every deed. All of it then will be justly rewarded or punished in the end. And so as verse 15 would say, I know we didn't read it, but as verse 15 would say in chapter 9, don't live to make a name for yourself again. Don't seek to be remembered. That poor man that's described in those verses who delivered his city, people don't remember him. He delivers the city, it's saved, and within a generation, oh, remember that guy who delivered? No, can't remember who. I know the city was delivered, but no idea who it was who did it. That's basically the point of those verses. Live in the light of death and be happy to be forgotten. Everything is in God's hands. When life seems unfair and when life is unpredictable, remember that God is just and God is in control. Everything is in his hands, including every single breath we breathe. And so we can trust him with it all.